Earlier this hour, we were talking about Georgetown University's decision to give admissions preference to descendants of the slaves once owned by the Maryland Jesuits. Two Maryland Jesuits who were presidents of Georgetown sold slaves to pay off Georgetown's debts in the early 1800s. Our next guest has thought a lot about how our history as a slave-owning nation informs our power structures today. Becca Meredith is a local activist and organizer for CARW, that's the Coalition for Anti-Racist Whites. Nationally, she works with SURGE, an acronym for Showing Up for Racial Justice. And she told me why it's important for white people to get involved in racial justice activism. Often it begins with white guilt.
By a feeling of that they have more than other people have, and that they've probably done a lot of little and big things in their lives that have been sort of playing out their white privilege. So I think actually white guilt is most often an entry place for white people. And
that's okay?
That's okay. I think the biggest piece is that when you're feeling that white guilt, that often guilt is actually immobilizing you. It's keeping you in the white culture. It's like, oh, I feel guilty about all these things. There's a retreating that happens. And, you know, sometimes we talk about guilt as actually a tool of racism to keep white folks in place because it's so uncomfortable to, like, move through that and to recognize I have no idea how to be in the world differently. And that's going to be a really hard path. And there's probably going to be a lot of guilt and shame and confusion. And so, yeah.
What are you asking white people to do?
We ask white folks to join the struggle for racial justice, educating yourself through reading or watching movies.
Educating myself about what?
What is, you know, what's racism? What is it?
Are you asking white folks to see themselves as racist?
You know, we do have a definition of racism as access to institutionalized power plus prejudice. Anyone can have prejudice, regardless of your race and how you've been racialized in this country. But because of the way the systems have been built in our country, only white folks have access to institutionalized power. And so often when you make that definition, you say that all white people are racist. We at CARW, which is the Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites, where I organize, we use that definition and we often give it. But what we find in terms of our end goal of mobilizing people towards action is that that definition or telling people that they all white folks are racist is like, yes, and don't get stuck in the guilt of it. We want to move you into action, to changing systems, to putting our bodies on the line, to having difficult conversations. And sometimes that sort of the weight of that definition is...
Yeah, you've already come to terms, possibly, with the idea of your own racism.
Yeah, but, I mean, yeah.
But to talk to somebody, to another white person is offended. White liberals hate to be called racist.
Mm-hmm.
It's threatening. Mm-hmm. It's offensive to many people.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you know you're actually doing any good? How do you know you're not just turning people off and creating hostility instead of what you want?
Yeah, I think... Organizing, you know, what we're doing is organizing a movement for social change is built on relationships. And we really operate in the model that we need to meet people where they're at. I think that goes for people in our families, but also, you know, we have a big meeting. We have a bunch of people on a big spectrum of their understanding of the work. And yeah, we want to be building bridges and not breaking them down. And so if that definition is really offensive to people, if that person is still open to a conversation about why it's offensive or discussing a way in which they can enter the work, often our fear of being labeled racist is really rooted in this sort of idea of perfectionism, which is so deep in our kind of white culture, which is, you know, it's like, I figured it all out. I did the research. I read the books. I don't say anything that's messed up. I got it. I'm fine. Don't like taint this that I've created. And so it's this really tight holding on this concept of perfectionism that is really harmful for our movements. And there's really no room to grow in that or get feedback. So I think kind of trying to support people in seeing that we're all flawed and we're all going to make mistakes and that's okay. And it's not actually your individual fault that you are a racist in our system, you know, that the system of racism has been built around you and you have inherited this.
Okay. That might make me a little more comfortable if I'm a well-meaning white person.
Yeah.
Right. That, oh, this is, it's not my fault. This is just the part I've been forced to play. I feel more comfortable. Do you want white folks to feel uncomfortable?
We do, ultimately, but we need you in the door first. So, okay, you're feeling a little better. You understand that it's not your fault that white supremacy exists and that you maybe walk around the world and do racist stuff every day. Now we kind of, we bring you in and we say, great, you want to be a part of this movement. One of the pieces of being a part of this work is getting uncomfortable.
How might I be uncomfortable? I'll be your, I'll be the surrogate here. I don't like to be uncomfortable.
You know, let's say you have a coworker. I know it sucks. It really sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you asking me to do?
I feel that. it could be really small. Like your partner at home kind of says something that's sort of off and you bring it up to them. I got
a partner or I have a friend who's or a family, especially family member, mm-hmm. right? Family.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they say something tone deaf.
Yeah.
But come on, that's just who they are. Are we going to ruin every friendship?
Right.
Over racism? What should I do about a friend, a family member?
Yeah.
I don't want to lecture them, Becca.
Right. I think there's two things to think about. One is that the work is built on relationships. So the goal of that conversation should always be to stay connected most of the time. I mean, I'm thinking about like the hyper sort of bigoted, just egregious behavior that you probably just don't really want to be around that person that much anyways. So that's sort of like the exception. But for folks that are kind of engaging in some kind of meaningful way, but they're just off, those are the folks we definitely want to talk to. And then so relationship building and also that you have no idea where that person is on their journey to waking up. And you might create that moment for someone else. And it just takes that risk of mentioning it. It may not be the crystallization moment, but it may be a seed that's going to be, you know, fully blossom in a year or 5 years. So I think not just assuming as much when you are hearing certain things from folks. We do this activity in CARW called naming and framing, which is basically a practice of having those difficult conversations. And, you know, sometimes it's good to start with questions. Like if someone says, it's so cool that Obama got elected, we're in a really post-racial society. It's beautiful.
What would I say to that?
Yeah, I mean, you can start with there's sort of different approaches. One could be questions. So that's really interesting. Where did you hear that? Oh, I heard it on blah, 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 this or that. Oh, okay. You know, sort of inquiring in and trying to figure out where did it come from? And maybe saying like, does it feel true to you? You know, because sometimes people are just regurgitating what they're hearing. So it's sort of connecting that person to their actual experience and maybe some other stories that are happening, like Black people getting killed every week, you know, every 28 hours in this country. Does that feel like we're in a post-racial society? You know, just kind of surfacing
questions.
Some
That's
facts.
Good. Questions are non-threatening.
They are. You know, they're a great way, especially for someone who you may feel might be defensive anyways, but I think it's just a good approach. Sometimes it's good to really go back to your own experience. So, you know, I used to think we were in a post-racial society too. You know, back in 2008, that, you know, Obama got elected, it was so amazing. And, you know, the other day I heard about this White Lives Matter group, which is now being dubbed a hate group. And I'm just realizing that we are not in a post-racial society, you know, and so just sharing your own journey.
And you started on common ground. Oh, yeah. I thought the exact same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then it's like, let me tell you a story, because everybody loves a story.
Exactly.
And we've already agreed that we're together.
Yeah.
And then this happened.
Yeah.
You've talked about taking a risk. Mm. On the surface, in liberal Seattle, organizing with a group called Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites doesn't sound very risky. It can sound a little self-congratulatory, you know, group of good white people. So I'm asking, what are you risking in Seattle by being anti-racist? And do you have
good
to risk?
Question.
Should you be risking something?
I think we should all be risking something to change the way that things are. And we should all be finding that edge for our own personal growth.
Yeah. Where's that edge for you?
For me right now, my risk edge is being more vocal and more visible in the Seattle racial justice movement.
Why is that risky?
Because I'm worried that I'm going to screw up, say the wrong thing on radio.
Yeah, you're in front of a microphone. That's risky. But what would you say wrong? You're talking about anti-racism. That seems like safe ground.
Because this world, this organizing is multifaceted and people have different approaches. And, you know, I'm a white person who's getting airtime. Shouldn't a person of color be sitting in this seat?
Do you think there's truth to that? Are you soaking up somebody's attention or being presumptuous right now by being a coalition of anti-racist white people?
I definitely think it's true. We need to pass the mic. White folks are used to being heard. That was a big practice of mine early on when I sort of came into the work, and I've always been kind of a whatever that word is, sort of overachiever in school. I know the answer, and you know, I sort of came in with that kind of energy, and I've learned a lot of kind of just stepping back and following the leadership of folks of color in this work who are on the front lines every freaking day and just like leading with action and vision that is just, you know, paving the way for this organizing. And I'm just, everything that I have learned is so much tied to folks of color in this work. And we are often asked and have been asked for generations as white folks to organize our people and educate our people.
Do white people need to lose something, to sacrifice something for people of color to get some justice?
You know, I think we operate on a sort of really deep level that we all will benefit from racism ending. We all gain. We are all dehumanized by the system of racism that plays out in this country, and we really need to come into the work seeing our own stake in it.
Becca Meredith is an organizer for CARW, the Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites, and Surge, showing up for racial justice.